Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, April 10th. Some of you know I've been keeping various indices and figures on spreadsheets, the old-fashioned hard copy ledger paper kind, since March 1990. And one of the items I scribble down each week is U.S. steel production. I've been meaning to glance back from year earlier levels to see where we've come, and it's quite telling. For the last 4 weeks, the numbers are 17, 15, 17, 20, 17, 34, and 17, 12. That's thousands of tons. The last 17, 12 is the first down week in 14. For 2009, the corresponding numbers were 976, 1027, 1006, and 965, as the economy and markets were bottoming back then. So quite a recovery, at least by this barometer of economic activity. But what now? I got a kick out of those who got all giddy over the March same-store sales figures for the largest retailers this week, up a strong 9%. I was half listening to some of the numbers and thought, boy, February to March, that is strong. But of course, it was 9% over March 2009, like whoop-de-damn-do. Heck, we were thinking depression March 2009, though that was also when I was telling stock investors to stay the course. I mean, with the significant improvement in the overall economy, I'd hope some of us spent $10.90 last month compared to $10 a year ago. So no, I'm not giddy. Many did quickly add that Easter came early, after all, and Macy's, for one, said April would be flat. In a nutshell, the two sides of the economic argument break down thusly. One side is best represented by the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee minutes for its March meeting, wherein the Fed mused, household spending will continue to be constrained by a weak labor market, housing, tight credit, and little wage growth. The Fed, in turn, will be keeping short-term interest rates low. Couple this with the European Central Bank, which isn't expected to increase its rates until 2011 at this point. And you can see why economist Nouriel Roubini would say that central banks around the world will keep rates low longer than expected. This is seen as necessary because, remember, stimulus programs are coming off the book at the same time, so it's imperative to keep rates low to avoid a double dip. But the other side argues that the economy, pretty much around the world, is gaining momentum. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan said capital investment is coming back and that purchasing managers need to build inventories to protect their position. After all, he offers, it takes longer to acquire the raw materials. Morgan Stanley economist Richard Berner says consumers have fixed their balance sheets more than people think, and that while the labor market will remain soft, modest gains in wages can be expected in the second half. Morgan Stanley sees a 10-year treasury of 5.50% by year-end as the Fed begins to raise rates in the third quarter due to the increasing pace of the recovery. Me? I agree with Chairman Bernanke, who gave a number of presentations this week and in one said there is no evidence of a sustained recovery in housing and, more broadly speaking, we are far from being out of the woods. I've said it's about housing and jobs, and with housing still stuck in the mud, wages, as I keep telling my inflation hawk friends, are as well. I have to laugh when those who've been crying wolf on inflation for years forget the basic principle that wages make up the single largest component of a finished product, and with excess capacity around the world, someone tell me why I should be concerned about wage pressures. Where is the pricing power that would begin to allow employers to reward their employees? Little in the fact employers will be trying to figure out the impact of the new healthcare legislation on their balance sheets for months to come. Inflation, as measured by consumer prices in the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, was just 1.5% in 30 developed nations in February from a year earlier, a record low. Again, while we've seen the headlines on commodities prices, the bigger picture is it's still about global excess capacity. Goldman Sachs sees core inflation falling further this year to about 0.3% in the U.S. and 0.2% in the euro area. Japan, as you're well aware, has been in a deflationary mode for years. Certainly, this kind of environment doesn't bode well for corporate profits, let alone hiring sprees. But coming off the lows of last year and back to the fall of 2008 when the financial crisis hit in earnest, earnings, when compared to these levels, have been strong, and a new round of reports versus last year are going to start hitting this week. No doubt they will be strong as well. It's just what happens in the second half of the year. There are a ton of geopolitical events that I expect to work their way into the equation, and I'm continually surprised at how virtually not a single market strategist ever brings this up. Then again, they never do until it's right on top of them. And then you have this issue of tax increases. Not for nothing, but not everyone earning over $200,000, $250,000 for couples is rich. Yet it's not just the expiration of the Bush tax cuts for the top bracket that is being eliminated, it's all manner of other taxes, including on health care, capital gains, and dividends, and God knows what else down the road that will begin to bite. USA Today, though, cited a Quinnipiac University poll in March that found that 60% of Americans support raising taxes on those earning more than $250,000 if the money is used to reduce the deficit. But that's the problem. Spending is off the table. That's the single reason why some of us believe the system is broken. We're not talking about Congress being able to pass legislation. It's about its total inability and that of the American people to deal with the deficits. Congress is incapable of attacking the spending side of the equation, and the American people are incapable of sacrificing when it comes to their entitlements. Without cuts in both, the looming deficit time bomb can't be defused. Ben Bernanke, in a speech this week, laid out the difficult choices. Quote, to avoid large and ultimately unsustainable budget deficits, the nation will ultimately have to choose among higher taxes, modifications to entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare, less spending on everything else from education to defense, or some combination of the above. Close quote. So, no, I'm not in the least bit optimistic about the future. A few last items of import. The Greek credit crisis exploded anew as interest rates on Greek bonds soared, with the two-year yielding a staggering 7.37% before rallying down to 6.93% on Friday. Greece thought it had found a short-term solution with the joint declaration in March that the European Union and IMF were prepared to backstop Greece should the government's fiscal stability plan not work and default become an issue. But until Friday, Greece's bonds and stock market were in freefall as Fitch Ratings piled on in cutting the rating on Greece's debt to the lowest investment grade. George Soros told Bloomberg, "It is a make-or-break time for the euro, and it's a question whether the political will to hold Europe together is there or not." Greece still has to find buyers for $40 billion in debt by end of May, at a time when long-term investors, not just the hedge funds, are losing faith rapidly. PIMCO's Mohamed El Arian in an op-ed for the Financial Times. It should be apparent to all by now, despite the rhetoric out of some European capitals, the Greek rescue package is not going according to plan. In fact, market measures of risk signal more concern today than before the announcement of EU IMF aid if necessary. Meanwhile, worries are mounting about the health of the Greek banking system, raising the specter of disorderly outflows of deposits. Society is not buying into the government's adjustment plan. El Arian continues, unfortunately, it is likely that things will get worse for Greece before they get better. In the short run, the persistence of alarming risk spreads will lead to even more cautious behavior among depositors and investors. Late movers will sell Greek assets rather than buy, putting even greater pressure on the government's ability to raise sustainable funding for its forthcoming debt maturities in May. Against this background, we should expect an intensification of the European blame game in the weeks ahead. Greece will complain about the lack of meaningful support from its European neighbors. They, in turn, will point the finger right back, noting the urgent need for Greek austerity, and the IMF will be pulled in all directions, including by those hoping that the institution can engineer an immaculate recovery for Greece. Buoyed by a cyclical recovery, markets around the world have yet to recognize the complexity of this situation. When they do, it will also become apparent that Greece is part of a wider and historically unfamiliar phenomenon, that of a simultaneous and large disruption to the balance sheet of many industrial countries. Tighten your seatbelts. That was PIMCO's Mohamed El Arian. On Friday, however, European Union officials did apparently come up with a plan for a possible loan to Greece at interest rates below what it has been paying. We'll learn far more by Monday, though, as El Arian points out, the crisis is far from over. But there was a bit of good news this week. The U.S. and China are repairing their relationship as Treasury Secretary Geithner made a surprise quick visit to Beijing to meet with a Chinese counterpart, which comes after Geithner postponed an April 15 deadline for a semi-annual review of the currency policies of major U.S. trading partners that was close to branding China a currency manipulator. President Hu Jintao is coming to Washington this week to take part in President Obama's summit on nuclear security, and then the U.S. is sending more officials to Beijing in May as part of a series of talks known as the U.S.-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue. Then you have the G20 in June, where currency could be at the top of the agenda and not just the U.S. blaming China. So it behooves China to make a token gesture on its currency, and this will happen shortly. Turning to stocks, the great rally no one respects continued as equities rose for a sixth consecutive week, an eighth in nine, with the Dow Jones touching 11,000 late Friday before settling at 10,997, up 0.6%. The last time the Dow was at that mark was September 2008, shortly after Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. The S&P 500 rose 1.4% and NASDAQ 2.1% to 2454. For NASDAQ, its highest close since June 08. Meanwhile, bonds staged a rally in part thanks to a well-received 10-year Treasury auction, and the 10-year finished up the week at 3.88%. But just another opinion from the Fed. Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City President Thomas Hoenig is on the other side of the inflation debate and argues his fellow Fed board members should start boosting interest rates soon, warning a delay could unleash inflation. When rate increases are delayed, Hoenig says, quote, the outcome too often is greater inflation, significant credit and market imbalances, and an eventual financial crisis. Hoenig has been the lone dissenter each of the last two Fed open market committee sessions, where the rest of the board has opted to keep rates unchanged and at record lows for an extended period. That's all for this week. I will not be doing podcasts the next two weekends, so I will be back with you around May 1st. I'm going on an extended trip to Albania and then Beirut, Lebanon. So please check in on my into my week in review column at stocksandnews.com. Have a great week.